Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, my name is Naomi Lambert from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share articles with you from The Assembly, which publishes in-depth reporting on North Carolina at theassemblync.com. Starting this week with a legend of North Carolina politics, Jesse Helms. How Jesse Helms paved the way for Donald Trump. And this is an article by William Link. So this is based on a book by Link called Jesse Helms, Modern Conservatism and the Politics of Opposition. And this is a new book, and these are excerpts from his book, which is published by UNC Press. In early January 1973, Joe Biden, a newly elected 30-year-old U.S. senator from Delaware, was sworn in along with Jesse Helms and 10 others. A moderate Democrat, Biden soon developed an unfavorable opinion of Helms, the first Republican elected to statewide office in North Carolina since 1898. After complaining to Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield that Helms had no social redeeming value, Biden changed his opinion when he learned that Helms had adopted a 9-year-old child, Charles, who suffered from cerebral palsy. Feeling like a fool, Biden learned his lesson. From that moment on, he later declared, I tried to look past the caricatures of my colleagues and try to see the whole person. For all the intensity with which he takes on issues and for all the depth of his feelings about issues that are so socially highly charged, left and right, Biden added, Helms was a man who has a very, very soft side. Although some of his more combative Democratic friends might be skeptical of me, Biden said, they don't know Jesse Helms like I do. Helms's staffers remained devoted to him over the years, and not just because they shared his conservative ideas. Elizabeth Seifert, who worked as a Senate aide in the 1990s, described how Helms ran his office. He gave legislative aides like Seifert considerable autonomy. She found the senator open and solicitous in his dealings with staff. He was a terrific boss, incredibly giving boss. Working in Helms's Senate office, she recalled, was like being in a family. When Helms learned about Seifert's mother's birthday, he asked for her phone number so that he could call her. In his office, he liked to line the wall with cartoons making fun of him, particularly those from the Raleigh News and Observer. Seifert concluded that Helms usually enjoyed political combat with his enemies. Helms has often been underestimated by his adversaries and by historians, often parodied as an inept Southern buffoon. The reality was far different. He was an able rhetorician, skilled at communicating a populist, anti-elitist message. Understanding the power of words and images for ordinary Americans, Helms was especially effective at using modern broadcasting media. At their peril, many of his political opponents ignored his facility with language and clever argumentation and his ability to connect with North Carolinians and conservatives nationally. A conservative senator described Helms as having an innate craftiness and cleverness that's stunning to watch. You can't box him in. He'll defang you when you get close. Anyone who sells him short is going to lose, and has. He's amazing and formidable. These diverse yet similar experiences were not unique. Helms was a complicated politician who was harsh in public and often gracious in private. Contemporaries, even some liberals, encountered more complexity in his political personality. Jack Betts, who wrote for the Greensboro Daily News and the Charlotte Observer, was an undergraduate at UNC Chapel Hill during the 1960s. He remembered that he and his dorm mates watched broadcasts of Helms' TV editorials, which we thought were hilarious. But Betts, living inside the Chapel Hill bubble, later admitted that he had underestimated Helms' connection with ordinary North Carolinians. Indeed, the more time reporters spent with Helms, the more they found him complex, even charming. Although Helms could be prickly with the press, Betts often found him to be warm and engaging. In private exchanges, he was often courtly and polite, but he could also cut off a piece of meat while smiling at you. Betts noted that it was fun to cover him when he reported on Helms in the 1970s, because he stirred so much passion among supporters and opponents that you always got a good story. Betts noted that people often made the mistake of dismissing Helms as an unlettered rube. Without question, Helms's political style was polarizing and defined political divisions that persist today. A sympathetic conservative, Human Events editor M. Stanton Evans described him as the soul of Southern courtesy, soft-spoken and polite, and whose main concern appeared to be to put the person he is with at ease. Helms's soft side disguised a political ruthlessness. Among modern conservatives, he paved the way with his brutal style of campaigning, with his relentless pursuit of what came to be known as culture wars, and as a tactician who used the Senate as a podium to rally a national constituency. What remains is a contradiction between Helms's commitment to public morality and his willingness to do whatever it took to communicate his message, and in elections, whatever it took to win. The contradiction verges on hypocrisy. Christian love was not practiced in his brutal world of politics. Helms used race and sexuality to harvest political power out of white fears about the decline of white supremacy and changes affecting the family. He vigorously defended the racial status quo of the Jim Crow era and attacked the black-led civil rights movement and its liberal white allies. His political rhetoric tapped into this powerful, often tribal response of white Southerners, but without the rough edges of the 1950s and early 1960s segregationists. At the same time, his main appeal to North Carolina voters and his national constituency was his honesty and adherence to traditional moral values. In my 2008 book, Righteous Warrior, I intended to avoid the ideologically charged caricatures of the right and left, and instead endeavoured to understand and assess Helms's impact during the last third of the 20th century. Writing a biography of a living person was risky, but especially so when the old wounds that Helms inflicted still festered. As a result, the book enjoyed the approval of neither side of the polarized political environment. Many of my colleagues were and are astounded that anyone could abide writing such a book. At the same time, Righteous Warrior was written without the approval of Helms and his supporters, though I interviewed many of them. Once the book was published, some of them complained loudly about what they thought was unfair treatment of Helms, especially on matters of race. Nearly two decades after his death, Helms continues to polarize those who remember him. There are few figures more important than Helms in the emergence of modern conservatism, more forceful in articulating an ideologically charged agenda, more effective in fashioning a message with wide popular appeal, and more successful in implementing a political strategy to gain power. He led an important transformation in late 20th century American politics, in which a deep political polarization remade the electoral landscape. Beginning as a newspaper reporter after World War II, Helms became a radio broadcaster. After working in the bruising 1950 North Carolina Senate campaign and a brief stint as a congressional staffer, Helms worked for the North Carolina Bankers Association, and in 1960 moved into television and ran WRAL, then Raleigh's leading TV station. With his broadcasting background, he developed a keen notion of how to market political ideas using modern media. He thoroughly understood how to reach people and communicate in terms that they understood. From 1960 to 1972, Helms became a television editorialist, commanding a wide following in North Carolina, especially in the eastern third of the state. Among modern conservatives, no other major figure in this era demonstrated the cunning racism, Christian cultural outrage, organizational abilities and political savvy in one man as clearly as did Helms, whose life's work sought to upend the political status quo in America. He became an anti-communist conservative during the 1950s and 60s, opposed to the further expansion of federal power, supported a reversal of New Deal policies in labor, agriculture, and social welfare, and criticized the leftward shift of national politics. His preferred methods of attack, sabotage, figurative bomb throwing, and the use of Senate rules, manipulated the legislative process to feed red meat to an increasingly angry political base. Helms internalized the small-town ethos of the South of the 1920s and 30s, an ethos that included white supremacy and a strict moral code. In this sense, he was little different from the most white Southerners of his generation. Helms was a determined opponent of civil rights and the African-American movement to upend white supremacy. In his five Senate campaigns between 1972 and 1996, he attracted remarkably few African-American votes, even for a Southern Republican. In 1954 and after, he opposed the U.S. Supreme Court's Brown versus the Board of Education requirement that segregation in public schools end. He also loudly opposed the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act of 1964-65. Throughout his career, in striking contrast to other segregationists such as George Wallace and Strom Thurmond, he never wavered in his assessment of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. While opposing the Black Freedom Movement, Helms also waged a culture war against the 1960s sexual revolution and the apparent triumph of secularization in American public life. The civil rights movement was lawless, he claimed, and reflected the moral decline of the sexual revolution, as were sit-ins, campus revolt, women's liberation, and other protest movements incorporating the tactics of the civil rights movement. Helms consistently connected immorality with civil rights leaders, especially Martin Luther King Jr., to undermine public support. In addition, Helms turned to political messaging that was rooted in fears of change in the late 20th century gender and sexuality. Beginning in the 1970s, he sponsored the mobilization of Christian evangelicals, a group that had long remained politically inactive. He used issues such as school prayer, abortion, non-profit status for private Christian schools, gay issues, and the general rubric of secular humanism. The organization of the Moral Majority in 1979 and the Christian Coalition about a decade later at least partly occurred under Helms' sponsorship. And in North Carolina, the mobilization of Christian evangelicals formed a crucial part of his electoral strategy. Raised in a conservative Southern Baptist tradition, Helms held traditional Christian values. His conservatism was rooted in Protestant fundamentalism. He had little trouble communicating with conservative evangelicals because he spoke their language, and by the late 1970s, he had become their most important leader in the Senate. By the 1980s, Helms aggressively used anti-gay rhetoric as a weapon in his political messaging. An open opponent of LGBTQ rights, Helms embraced homophobia as a cultural issue. In particular, he used the AIDS crisis to demonize gay people and firmly opposed expanding federal research into defeating the disease. Helms joined the U.S. Senate in 1973 on the heels of a rightward turn in American politics, and he occupied a prime seat in this political transformation. The Senate provided a stage for him to communicate his conservative message. He earned a reputation as Senator No, a designation that he eagerly embraced because of his obstructionist parliamentary tactics that led to few victories but brought the public spotlight on conservative issues. These tactics forced his liberal opponents in the Senate to engage in recorded votes, and he used their votes against them in subsequent elections. Rarely did Helms achieve legislative victory. In the 1970s, he had little interest in enacting legislation or making policy. Rather, his political strategy was to publicise issues and mobilise a national conservative constituency. After Ronald Reagan's election as president in 1980, Helms became the American Right's leading congressional spokesperson. During the subsequent 12 years of Republican control of the White House, he usually occupied the right flank, fighting pragmatists and insisting on ideological purity. During the early 80s, he promoted the conservative political agenda regarding school busing, school prayer, and abortion. Helms rallied his conservative constituency not only because he possessed the forum of the Senate, but because he assembled a formidable political machine that succeeded in fundraising, using broadcast media and communicating a compelling political message. The National Congressional Club, founded in 1973, supplied the muscle for Helms to win elections and to become a national conservative leader. It pioneered new methods of political communication. The club attracted an assortment of committed conservatives, youthful ideologues, and most important, creative innovators in a new style of politics that depended on opinion polls, targeted political advertising, and slash-and-burn attacks. Between 1978 and 1990, the club became a full-time operation fighting for the conservative revolution. The clubs and Helms became known for their bruising, take-no-prisoners political style that relied on character attacks and negative advertising. Helms's political advertising also relied on wedge issues to divide the electorate, most especially with issues emphasizing race and sexuality. His political organization pioneered these techniques, which were widely duplicated by political managers on all sides of the ideological spectrum across the country. Return to the past. In many respects, Helms's political career is crucial for understanding the evolution of modern conservatism. Donald J. Trump and MAGA Republicanism. Both Helms and Trump urged a return to a past in which white men were dominant. By the end of the 20th century, a large wealth gap separated the older industrial and agricultural areas from those driven by knowledge-based technology and finance. Today, the gap is particularly evident in North Carolina in the contrast between the Raleigh-Durham megalopolis, where tech and finance have thrived, and the hinterlands of central North Carolina, where a dying manufacturing plant has left a deindustrialized core. Appeals to traditional morality and the decline of the patriarchal family resonated in this world. In those hinterlands is where Trump thrived, securing just enough support from a mobilized and energized base for narrow victories, employing the same playbook that Helms used. Well beyond his retirement in 2002 and his death in 2008, Helms paved the way for the Trump era. Though Helms would have been scandalized by Trump, the two men shared many political attributes. Trump tapped into many of the same fears and prejudices that sustained Helms and his political machine. Both Helms and Trump relied on populist rhetoric that demonized liberal elites for what they portrayed as imposing alien cultural values. Both greatly relied on the use of attack politics through heavy television advertising that coalesced the national conservative constituency. Like Trump, Helms belittled his opponents to feed his base in North Carolina and nationally. Like Trump, he had little interest in political moderation and instead fanned political divisions. And like Trump, Helms won by narrow margins and his strategy depended on his fully aroused supporters. A majority of North Carolina voters admired Helms's tenacity and they sent him to the Senate 5 times. Conservatives nationwide relied on him to energize the movement. His life charts the emergence of modern American conservatism. Helms both capitalized on and drove the polarization that fueled Trump's rise. Helms relied on support from the state's small towns and countryside, but he also attracted urban and suburban support in areas containing older industries, such as the Swatch of North Carolina's cotton, textile, and furniture factories that underwent deindustrialization during and after the 1970s. Like Trump, Helms had a political base of working-class voters, and as the News and Observer's Rob Christensen puts it, race always was a good way to connect with his supporters because it worked. This white tribalism became an effective way of winning elections. While Helms was pretty shrewd politically, Christensen said, these racial attitudes were something deep in his bones. Staying on articles about federally elected officials, the U.S. House committee investigated Alma Adams for alleged inappropriate relationship with staffer, and this is by Kadia Goba. The U.S. House Ethics Committee interviewed a number of Representative Alma Adams' former aides as part of an investigation into an alleged inappropriate relationship between the lawmaker and a staffer who works out of her North Carolina district office. Over the course of several months in 2023, committee staff interviewed roughly half a dozen former aides, some of whom were working for Adams at the time, in Washington and Charlotte, about Adams's relationship with her now Deputy Chief of Staff and District Director, Sandra Brown, according to four people interviewed by the committee who were granted anonymity to speak freely about the sensitive matter. The interview started as early as January 2023, and continued until at least September 2023. Adams, now 79, was made aware of the ethics complaint filed against her in the summer of 2022, according to the people we spoke with. The exact nature of Adams's relationship with Brown is unclear, but a high-ranking staffer filed a complaint with the committee after the staffer was told by colleagues that the congresswoman was in a relationship with an aide. All of the people that spoke with us said that, at the very least, Brown's extremely close relationship with Adams resulted in a hostile work environment. Adams repeatedly led the North Carolina delegation in staff turnover. The Ethics Committee investigation was not announced and has not been previously reported. The committee has not released its findings, but the fact that investigators traveled to North Carolina to conduct interviews indicates the scope of the probe. The committee declined to comment when asked about Adams, but Chair Michael Guest, who does not comment on any individual cases, said the committee does not intend to publish the names of individuals against whom allegations have been made that we are unable to substantiate. At least one former staffer told us that they were interviewed in a hotel in North Carolina. According to several sources, witnesses interviewed were peppered with questions about their time in the congresswoman's office and about a different staffer who was being investigated for financial mismanagement. The line of questioning, however, quickly narrowed to Adams's relationship with Brown. I got asked a very direct question about whether or not they were having an inappropriate relationship, said one person who spoke with the committee, referring to Adams and Brown. A spokesperson for Adams said that the committee closed the matter after finding no violation of any house rules and, most importantly, no inappropriate or improper relationship. Ultimately, the committee advised that Congresswoman Adams should work to ensure that no staff receive preferential treatment, actual or perceived, and that all staff were aware they could raise any concerns without fear of retaliation. The spokesperson added, saying that Adams did not face any penalties because she hadn't broken any rules. Multiple former aides told the committee that Brown appeared to spend long stretches at Adams's one-bedroom apartment on New Jersey Avenue in Washington, sources said. And at least one former aide said Brown, who worked out of the Charlotte office, sometimes appeared in the background of virtual calls the congresswoman participated in from her Washington apartment. Witnesses were also asked about a self-published novel authored by Brown, Boss Lady, The Legend of Sidney Donovan Begins. That touches on a woman who clashes with her lover's husband. Brown wrote the book under a pseudonym but reveals her identity in the author's section of her Amazon page. Brown told at least one aide that the book was loosely based on her life, a source with direct knowledge of the matter told us. Some staffers described witnessing in-person and virtual shouting matches between Adams and Brown. Others described Brown as having an outsized managerial role in the office, oftentimes overruling higher-ranking aides. Adams's spokesperson did not address these allegations, and Brown did not return a request for comment. Your standing with Sandra impacted your standing with Alma, one former aide told us, adding that current staffers are still seeking advice on how to navigate the office's dynamics. Brown worked with Adams during her time in the North Carolina State Legislature as an administrative assistant. Her roles in Adams's congressional office spanned from scheduler to deputy chief of staff over a period of about a decade. The Ethics Committee recently said that it has conducted 20 investigations related to allegations of sexual misconduct by members of Congress since 2017, but the committee identified only 15 lawmakers who faced allegations that had previously been made public. Adams's name was not listed. Guest explained why the committee would have omitted those five names. In general, because those matters were looked into by the committee and we could not verify the allegations that were made, Guest told us. House members are prohibited from engaging in romantic relationships with any House employee directly under their supervision, according to an amendment in the chamber's official code of conduct. None of the sources are alleging that Adams's relationship with Brown was non-consensual, but recent allegations against multiple lawmakers have resulted in high-profile probes by the committee, with several lawmakers resigning as a result. Former Representative Tony Gonzalez of Texas had been under investigation for sexual misconduct. Gonzalez admitted to an affair with a staffer who later died by suicide. Multiple women, including a former aide, have accused former Representative Alex Swalwell of an array of sexual misconduct, from sending explicit photos to rape. Swalwell has denied the allegations against him, but both men resigned from Congress last week. The Ethics Committee is also investigating Florida Representative Corey Mills for sexual misconduct, among other allegations ranging from campaign finance violations to improperly receiving gifts. Mills has denied wrongdoing and remains in Congress, but faces an expulsion threat. And that article was by Kadia Guber. We have run out of time for today's episode of The Assembly. We hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in next time. I'm Naomi Lambert for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is now available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long till next time, and if you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.